From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in cerebral Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and games development. I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve Berger, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark LaCroix. I, too, make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are interactivity versus play and fail states in art. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start.
Weather talk.
Right, yeah, we promised it in the last episode.
Apologies, but weather talk.
This is a Minnesota podcast. It's going to happen. It snowed.
It's today. The first snow.
Yeah.
How dare.
I want it to, like, it should either just snow a lot or not snow.
It's a threat is what it is.
Yeah.
A harbinger.
Here's a couple. That'll be gone by evening. But there's more coming.
Yep.
Just you wish.
I've heard.
Don't get comfortable.
I've heard that this winter in particular is going to be very rough.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh. So that is what I've heard. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Well, it's all get cozy. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because, like, seasonality is something I really love and enjoy just as a thing. Mm-hmm. And the only seasonal thing with games for me is that something about winter makes me really love word games.
Okay.
So, like, I love just, like, laying in bed doing crossword puzzles with Ian or playing Scrabble always feels... Like, I like playing Scrabble with people, but something about winter feels more appropriate.
Yeah.
And so I've been playing a lot of wordplay. as my nighttime roguelike,
cool.
And that's been really fun. I don't know. I'm curious, actually, from the nice listeners, if you have any seasonality with games. I think the obvious one is, like, horror games during Halloween, but, like, is there something where it's just like, the first moment of spring, I must play a hack and slash. I must destroy something.
Yeah.
I definitely find myself, I'm not seasonal in any way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I wear the same clothes all year round. Mm-hmm. So it's unusual for me to hear people talk about how their interests change or, like, how there are things they like to do in fall but not in spring.
Yeah.
And obviously there are things that are available to do in fall and not in spring.
So
there's that to it, of course. But I have a hard time wrapping my mind around that. It's not just not the way I operate.
Sure.
But I suppose I'm probably the weird one.
I'm sure there's a lot of folks that who
are also weird. I know
seasonality is also very cultural. So Japan is extremely seasonal,
sure.
And I love that. But so you think about, like, convenience stores, like, oh, it's Halloween. There's all the Halloween stuff. But, like, the flavors of stuff that you can get in convenience stores changes because with the season.
Sure.
So it's like if you go to a convenience store in Japan in the fall, like, there's sweet potato stuff, mushroom flavored stuff.
Yeah.
Kabocha or pumpkin flavored stuff, like, and chestnut flavored stuff everywhere.
Mm, yeah.
And then, like, later on, like, a couple months down past that into, like, December, it's going to be different too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the best thing we have in America is the McFlurry.
So, I was going to say we change seasons based off of what sport is we're supposed to be paying attention to.
I suppose.
Yeah. So. Truly, it is sports and holidays for us. So I don't think you're abnormal in our cultural context.
Okay. I'm feeling better already.
Good.
Although there's a grocery store right here next to Noble Robot that I go to, like, multiple times a week to get snacks and stuff.
Yeah.
And, like, they bring out all of the November baked goods.
Oh, sure.
It's not quite Christmas cookies yet, but it's definitely like, okay, this is definitely not a thing you sell all year round.
Yeah. Mm-hmm,
so we have pockets of that kind of thing, I guess. I mean, it gets people kind of, I don't know, excited about winter because you gotta give them something to get excited about.
Yeah.
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 Jeez.
Something for October that I always do, if not more than once in the year, but always I try to do in October, I try to listen to my favorite symphony, which is the Symphony Fantastique.
Uh-huh.
And I'm gonna get to see it at the Minnesota Symphony Orchestra.
Yeah.
I'm very excited.
Yeah, that's exciting.
And it's also apparent, like, I've been to the orchestra here and I have not actually seen Sondergaard conduct yet.
Uh-huh.
Oh.
It's been years. And so that's gonna be kind of fun, but I'm excited.
Yeah.
This is the thing you do every year.
I listen to the Symphony Fantastique every year because the premise of the symphony is that there's this artist who gets dumped by his girlfriend.
Uh-huh.
And he is so depressed and heartbroken that he just, like, poisons himself with opium and he goes on an awful trip.
Oh,
so
dear.
act, so the movements are his different dreams. Yeah. So he, first he's like in a ballroom where it's waltzes, and there's this reoccurring, there's this fixie day, which are like, or idée fixe, which is like a reoccurring motif of the girlfriend, and it appears and changes every single time as she kind of like follows him around. So it's a ball with lots of waltzing. Then it's a lonely, like, pastoral scene with a thunderstorm approaching. Then he's executed at the guillotine for murder. And you actually hear his head bounce if the orchestra does it right.
Oh, ew.
And then the last movement is the witch's Sabbath. He's attending his own funeral, and the clock chimes midnight, and all of the skeletons and the ghouls and the witches come out, and it appears that his girlfriend is actually like now this kooky witch, like she was evil all the time. So it's a five movement symphony of this guy's wild drug trip. It's great.
It's actually really interesting.
Festive.
It's so good. But I listen to it every October because of the Witch's Sabbath for Halloween.
Yeah.
And you can hear, it's very, like, you can hear all of the little bits. Like, it's very good narrative through audio. Like, one of the things I loved about it as a kid, because I wanted more music with stories.
Yeah.
But, like, one of the things that's really cool is that when the skeletons come out and they're dancing, the violinists flip their bows upside down, and they tap the wooden part of their bows against their instruments to make that, like, clickety-clickety of the bones of the skeletons dancing.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, there's, like, I love when musical forms are forced into sort of creativity like that.
Yeah.
Like they use the tools they have in front of them to like to have a broader voice.
Yeah.
That's very fun.
I think it's cool like when they ask for things. So like, I mean, Wagner specifically has like in the score, which size anvils and hammers to bring for the like, the sounds of the dwarves under the volcano. That part, he actually lists out the hammers and anvils as like, along with like this many violas, this many violins, this many.
Does not surprise me about Wagner.
No, not in the slightest. But then like, yeah. And then Berlioz, he has all of these, like so many sounds he can get out of a 90 piece orchestra.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love it. It's great.
Impressive.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
I, along with my lovely wife and show producer Dale, went and saw David Byrne last week.
Neat.
Here in Minneapolis. Very, very fun. David Byrne is, you know, famously of Talking Heads, probably my favorite band. And I've seen him at every opportunity I can. It's one of those things where you have like a favorite band and then after a while you don't realize like, oh, I've actually seen them quite a lot.
Oh.
And for essentially a legacy act, which is maybe unfair, but like he's, you know, Talking Heads is a very old band.
Yeah.
And he does solo tours, not super frequently,
mm-hmm.
But I've taken every opportunity to see him. I'm never disappointed. For folks, David Byrne is probably more popular now than he was a decade ago, sort of in the sort of zeitgeist of culture. But he had a show called American Utopia, which was a Broadway show, which was kind of a concert album. They made a film out of it, Spike Lee directed. I've talked about it on this show before.
Yeah.
Because it was, I went to New York to see that. This tour that he's on is an extension of a lot of the innovations that came from the American Utopia show.
Ah, okay.
Which include the entire band is wireless and untethered. So there's no drum kit. There's no risers. It's a completely bare stage.
Huh.
And all the performers, including the percussionists, they all just walk around freely.
Oh.
There's no set pieces. So in American Utopia, that was done with a very plain gray stage with this beautiful hanging chains on the sides of the theater to represent the bounds of the space.
Sure.
And so people could enter and exit it anywhere because it was just hanging chains.
Yeah.
That was very clever. This show expands on that by having a video floor. So that, you know, there's panels with LEDs on them that you put enough of them together and it's a video screen.
Yeah.
And then these curved video walls. So still a very empty blank space. And all the performers are wearing the same jumpsuit. And it's a piece of theater in a way that no other concert I've ever been to has been.
That's okay.
And
so cool.
Even though so many of its components are very recognizable from the 2020 show that he did, it is really very much it's almost like a new piece in the same genre that was invented for that show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where a lot of the actual components are the same, but it is still very much a very unique production of its own, particularly because of the video components. Each song was like a separate music video, and yet there were no set pieces, no visible crew.
Yeah.
Really, really clever, and some of it was very abstracted. And because he's played a lot of, you know, because he's been around a long time, he's got to play a lot of Talking Heads songs.
Sure, yeah. Right.
So you know, not everything like had a specific new story to tell.
Yeah.
But a lot of the songs did. And some of the older songs were rearranged to reflect modern sensibilities or a point that he was making.
Okay.
Just a brilliant piece of theater.
Cool.
The Who is the Sky tour. If David Byrne's coming to your town, please go see him. Very cool. And a fun little fact I learned, which we'll put in the show notes, the band leader for the band is a violinist. They play a 5-string violin, which is apparently not very common.
No.
Okay.
Just before the first show, it got knocked over and it broke.
Oh.
And they're like, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
So they called the production manager, called around, trying to like see who did it. Turns out the artisan who made the violin is from New Brighton.
Really?
Here in Minnesota, just a half an hour away from the concert venue.
Oh my gosh.
So they went to his shop and just got a new one.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there are a couple, like, apparently really good violin makers in Minnesota. There's one in Northfield as well, actually. Like, that's so cool
just
that it just,
wild
like,
coincidence.
It broke at home.
Yeah, like, not just but he had had that violin that he'd been using for 20 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then just, and realized that the person who made it was within...
Is right, was right next door.
Like, that's so cool.
Away. Yeah.
Hey.
Isn't that a great little, like, you know... Oh. You know, you're like, well, what is fate? Like,
yeah, right?
Amazing. This is the little story that can happen. So, you know, the show went on without, and apparently he likes the new one better. So,
okay.
Oh.
What a great little fun story.
Wait. Was it a new violin or did he get his old one repaired?
No, a new one.
Oh, brain stanking new. Okay.
Yeah. we'll put the link to that story in the show notes, but I was just flabbergasted about it. Like, what an incredible little thing. And then I was the beneficiary of that good grace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By being able to play the actual show that weekend.
Oh, that's cool. So cool.
Yeah. Other news from me is that I updated the Noble Robot website.
Nice.
So Noble Robot, for folks who don't know, is the company, my indie dev company. It's how I operate all of my commercial interests. It's basically just a single member LLC. It is important to me that the website represents all the services I provide, but also because it's the services I provide are kind of eclectic, to be as clean and unambiguous as possible, which is not always super easy.
Sure.
Having, you know, information, all the projects I worked on, detailing information about the office here, which we do co-working. We also hold events, so we need to have some, you know, some just like parking information, stuff like that, without being too overwhelming. And I recently decided to chuck my old web hosting provider and go with a new sort of back-end stack. This is all boring. You don't need to know any of these details. But the upshot is that it's a great opportunity for me just to redo all my websites.
Cool. Mm-hmm.
And so this was the first one I did because it draws the lowest amount of traffic.
Oh, okay.
You know, the Nice Games Club website, you know, gets hit every day with requests for people for the RSS feed, for episode pages, and for the actual, you know, the feed to get episodes. So that's a little harder to move. That's coming next year. We're going to make some updates there. The back end on that is not great. Listener, you can enjoy it, but we have a harder time with it.
Yeah.
And that's just a matter of that, you know, I pay almost nothing to host it on a really cheap thing. It's just a consequence of that.
Yeah.
But this was a good test bed for that. And so what I did for Noble Robot website is I just rebuilt it entirely from scratch.
Oh, okay.
Even though the new one is very similar to the old one. A lot of the design decisions about how to organize information, what information to provide on projects, what to write and how much, you know, screenshots and stuff to produce and to make it easy for me to maintain. I made a lot of those decisions many years ago and I'm pretty happy with it. But I wanted to spruce up the design a little bit. I feel like there's too many rounded corners in the universe, so I took most of those out of my website and went with a more sort of like magazine style layout.
Oh, cool.
At least I'd like to think. Mm-hmm. Changed the way I did some background imagery, and I'm really, really happy with the new design. But rather than just update the old website, I just completely rebuilt it from scratch. And it was a process that took me way too long. After Blippo Plus was released at the end of September, I went through that thing that everybody goes through. It's kind of like a post-project depression. I mean, Blippo was basically a success.
Yeah.
It was critically lauded. Players love it.
Mm-hmm.
It sold pretty well. Mm-hmm. And it's on track to have a pretty good tail. Great for me. Like, really, really good. Something I've, you know, more success than I've ever had in my professional career.
Yeah.
But those weeks afterward felt very similar to every other project I've done, where I'm just like, I feel like I'm moving like molasses.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of listeners who have released projects regardless of how they were received in the world, have had this experience.
Yep, I know I have.
And this is the world in which I built my new website, and it just took forever.
Yeah.
But it's finally done, mm-hmm. and of course, we'll put that in the show notes as well, so you can get a kind of look at that, even though it's not that exciting.
My topic, interactivity versus play. It's a combat for the ages.
Uh-huh.
Not really. So, Marcus...
So, buckle in, listeners. It's not a big deal.
Yes. Mark has been talking about Blipo Plus, and he just heard him talking about how successful it's been. But some of the folks who have been reviewing it have been describing it as not a game. And I'm upset on your behalf.
Oh, thank you.
Because that don't make no sense. It is a game. But what I've noted about people saying that is that I think we just don't really have great language to talk about games and things that we consider games or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing that I was thinking about with respect to this is that I think there is a distinction between like interactivity and play in a way that I think maybe if we like describe what that meant, we could get a broader understanding of what a game really is, mm-hmm. at least in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think that a game should be something that is both interactive and playful.
Mm-hmm.
And Blipo Plus definitely is that.
Yeah.
So to me, interactivity is the way I would define it is the player has active determination on what is expected or what is experienced in the game. So like a low end interactive thing is like a book, for instance. You just flip the pages. So you control, I guess, how quickly you can read it. But like other than that.
From jump, this is incredibly broad definition.
Yes.
Because
it doesn't have to be video games.
Because the interactivity you're talking about with a book is the interactivity of the physical object.
Interfacing.
Right.
Like with the somatic component of.
Right.
Yeah. This is where we draw the line of like what is art and what is the medium is the message and all that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. I mean, you can also describe it in you can describe like certain visual novels, kinetic visual novels that are the same story. You could describe it in that same way. Like you read them like you would a book.
Sure. So you're starting off from a very permissive definition.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's almost like stimulus and then you get feedback. Because like you could also say like someone who is not interactive, if you poke them and they do nothing, it's like, oh, that person's not being interactive.
Yes. Kind of. That is one way. You may want to call somebody if that's the case.
Right. So, well, I think to Lydia's point, let me give you a prompt here.
Yeah, sure.
Answer me this. If somebody, I'm just going to make this as weird as possible.
Okay.
They put their hand in like a black box, like a box with a hole in it. They roll some die.
Yes.
They don't see what the result is.
Yes.
But someone else does. And as a result of that, they give you an experience based on the roll of that die.
Yeah.
How interactive is that experience?
Boy, that is, that's...
There are like thousands of possibilities, let's say, but the user is in control of which one they get.
Yeah.
But they mechanically.
But as far as you know, it's just a random. To me, that's not very interactive. You're not really determining anything.
Okay.
It's just, in fact, you're the one, you may be the one rolling the die, but effectively, the die is just a thing.
It requires a higher level of agency.
So it's, it's stimulus. You get a response, you get feedback from a stimulus, and you have agency over what to do with that information.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does something because you did something.
Yeah.
But like you go to the cinema and you see one of these three movies is playing.
Yeah.
And you pick one to go watch.
Right.
If you include the experience of entering the lobby and going to the movies as part of that experience, that is an interactive.
I mean, in the literal definition, yes.
Yeah, in the like incredibly broadest perspective.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
You are an active agent.
I guess actually that's a good point. I am defining literally the word interactive.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily in a gameplay sense.
Okay.
But also think of it, if you extend that to games, this is kind of what I'm talking. This is what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to talk about play specifically. My definition of play, which I feel like I have a worse definition of, but argue with me, I guess.
Oh, you don't want that. There are people who go to school for this.
I meant you two.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't go to school for
this.
We're on
air, Lydia. The definition of play for me is the player is being invited to experience, think, or quote unquote play with something.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that like books are not low play. I think that like you can have a book that is low play. But you can also have a book, like think of a mystery novel, for instance.
Yeah.
Like the game, the book is inviting you to think about what is happening in it, in the narrative so that you can come up with your own conclusion as to what's going to happen. Or you can, you know, just follow along mm-hmm. with it. It's up to you. But like the book is presenting you with clues that you can think about as you're reading, as you're participating
yeah.
in this.
Yeah.
And then
in,
like
in the narrative.
So then like higher playbooks would be something like a pop-up book with little tabs or like the things that are like the ones with kids where you can open up doors or a choose your own adventure book.
Yes. Those are unambiguously playful like, in Stephen's definition.
Yes.
Because you can essentially prove that there's play.
Yeah.
I think, Stephen, you're describing a definition of play that is something we've talked about on the show before, which is the kind of thing that happens between your ears.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily have to be something. You don't have to be like, this is, and this is why I'm bringing up this, is it different?
It doesn't require interactivity.
Yes, exactly. It's different. Because like, yeah, if you're thinking about it and you're like, playing, I keep thinking of play because it's the only word I could think of when I'm describing this thing.
Yeah.
But like, if you're thinking about what is happening in the narrative and like coming to your own conclusions about it, or like, you know, thinking about like the moral complications or whatever else, yeah, I don't know.
If you're into that sort of thing,
if you want, like those kinds of things are play.
Yeah, it's you're very much poking at the person who is experiencing it is an active participant and is actively manipulating and engaging with what they are obtaining.
Yeah.
As opposed to just passively receiving it and storing it.
Exactly. Yeah, yes. Yeah.
And we would describe that as play because of the implications that it has for the kinds of works that we do.
Yeah.
But I would suspect that even a mystery writer who is intentionally wanting their readers to engage in that, they might not describe that as play.
They probably wouldn't.
Which doesn't mean one thing or the other about your definition, but it is sort of telling on like how different arenas invite different definitions.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So by this definition, I would describe a game example of low play as like tic-tac-toe. There's not a lot of like play involved. You put the X, you put the O in, and there's only 9 options.
Yeah, but you know that there's strategy to tic-tac-toe, right?
I know. But because the game is so old and people understand it now, the strategy has been, it's solved.
It's a solved game. So, yes. I mean, maybe a better example might be the card game War.
Yeah.
Which has no choices to make.
That's true.
You know, but still has a lot of interactivity.
Right. Yeah, you are the one actively placing the cards down.
Yeah.
So, you know. So, I wanted to bring that up because I was thinking about it with respect to Blippo. I think that Blippo does both of these things.
Yeah.
And well enough to be considered a game, so shut up. I guess. I don't know why I'm arguing about this so hard on your behalf, Mark. But
I'm going to send you into the comments section.
Yeah, Mark told me to beat you.
Yeah, we very clearly like taken our topics and just passed them to the right.
Yeah.
So that means I need to fight about something for you now, Steven.
Okay, we'll work on that.
Speaking to that, that reaction that people have had to Blippo by saying like it's not really a game.
Yeah.
Because and for folks who are not familiar, it's a TV channel flipping experience.
Yeah.
You change between channels, it's full motion video. It's a narrative game that is not choose your own adventure.
Right.
But you decide your path through it.
Yes.
So it kind of has that anyway, so on that basis, and there's a meta story that you need to think about. So I think that is enough for your two definitions to be very easily argued.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people have looked at that and said, well, you know, there's no point. You can't win or lose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not really a game. And I sort of take that sort of earnestly, like if I were to describe these definitions to them, they would probably, that same person would probably agree.
Yeah.
Sure, it's a game. But I think there's sort of a colloquial understanding. So I wish there was a greater understanding of what games are.
Right.
And, and what instead of us drawing a really tight fence around it,
yeah,
that's very much based on, you know, what most games are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think people have also described Blippo Plus as very weird, and I don't know that it's as weird as people think it is.
Yeah, sure.
Because of this, but at the same time, when people say it's not really a game, you should play it, I have no complaints.
Right.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
They are still advertising it, I guess.
Yeah,
they're saying good things about it.
Almost nobody has said that in a way that is meant to say that it's not a good experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess the thing that, where I feel like fisticuffs could start coming from the comments is the difference between a game and a playful experience.
Yeah.
Is there a difference? Is it it feels like it could be a circle, or no, not circle and square, a square and rectangle situation where one is always the other, but the other isn't always it.
Sure.
Because that might just be what they're saying is like, this isn't what I think of as a game, but it is a wonderful, playful experience and you should play it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it a toy?
Yeah.
Sometimes people.
Well, I won't even I don't know, a toy feels a little bit easier to define in some way. You wouldn't necessarily say that going through a museum exhibit or a special exhibit in a museum is a game, but you could have a very playful interactive experience.
Yes, sure. You can. That's a good point.
Yeah. Well, I use the word toy basically because you wouldn't easily apply it.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of, we have the limitations of language.
Like, yeah.
These words have connotations,
right,
that we're stretching, bending, and breaking.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And also carry the weight of genre and all the examples.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it's, you could, you know, there's no such thing as a fish, is a famous piece of trivia, mm-hmm, that you really cannot define something where something, you could look at something and actually determine if it's a fish or not.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm, you could also very obviously say that's a fish or not.
Right.
And so I think we're kind of, it's a similar with the word game, perhaps.
Yeah.
That it's contextual all the way down to its core.
I know that sometimes people describe games as just interactive media, which feels a little academic in a way I don't like.
It's also
it's what we do when we're looking for grant money.
Yeah.
But also media is inaccurate because what happens to playing a game of pretend on the playground?
Right.
Like that's one of the things that I know I have to keep remembering is that games are not just board game, card game, video game. Games are like, you know, floor is lava.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, I'm going to stare at you and whoever looks away first loses. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be ad hoc and impromptu, like truly could be Calvin Ball in that way. So then how does it, Genesis, I guess, is part of it, you know, because it isn't media.
Right.
The fact that it is on, like, you can get it on a Switch doesn't necessarily make something a game, but it also doesn't mean that it's not a game.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, like, This is why I want to talk about like these two different definitions, and it seems like we're in agreement on what these definitions make sense, at least for what we're talking about.
Yeah,
it helps, and also that
holding
them
kind of loosely is I think probably important.
Yeah.
Yes,
we've all talked about it a little bit differently, mm-hmm, but like there's not a lot of place for disagreement.
Yeah,
because we're all holding it pretty loosely.
That's true.
Yeah, and we're not trying to apply those words in anything that requires a rock solid, airtight definition. Like, we're not making a legal document, which would require us to have clear and agreed upon exacting language.
Sure.
We can do like the rough translations of like, that is more or less what I'm thinking of, or that's pretty much what I was said.
Yeah.
I understand what you mean, but you said it in a way that makes more sense to you.
Yeah.
That's like, in this context, that's totally fine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
Steven, do you think, to cut you off, do you think that kind of understanding that we all sort of have, and I think a lot of our listeners probably do too, because we've talked about this kind of thing before.
Yes.
Do you think that comes from experience and say not particular, not wisdom or knowledge? Like, as we tell our listeners how we feel about this, do we think that fully understanding that is a result of actually engaging in game development as a practice, or is it something you can explain to someone and they will understand?
That's a good question. I think it definitely has come due to our experience as making games.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I think that it is not as intuitive, and this is probably why, like, a critic might describe Blippo Plus as not a game.
Oh, sure.
Whereas a game developer would.
Okay. Okay.
It's because like a critic is critiquing things based off of their knowledge,
right?
And their understanding, mm-hmm, of what a game is. And we, you know, as game developers are oftentimes experimenting with things in a way that even a developer wouldn't necessarily consider a game yet until like you get to a certain point, I guess, and you feel like this game's got enough interactivity and play for it to feel like cohesive thing.
Like, it is doing the thing that games in my brain that games make my brain do.
Yeah.
I also agree with that. Just on the anecdotal experience I've had where like someone told me like, oh, I don't play video games. I'm like, I literally watch you play Farmville and Candy Crush every day.
Right.
Yeah.
What do you mean you don't play video games? And like, to them, that is not what video game is.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
No. I mean, also literally for me earlier when I was a kid, I thought the video games had to be on console. I thought I didn't play video games. Mm-hmm. I thought computer games were different. So then that was like a huge paradigm shift for me in high school.
Yeah. And I think in that respect, that's kind of more of a cultural thing, but it's still related in a way. I think that, like, I guess to your question, Mark, I think that, like, it is difficult to express this idea of, unless you've, like, actively tried to make a game before, because, like, it's just, like, a weird idea.
Yeah.
Like, I think people think about games colloquially, mm-hmm, and not in terms of, like, actual academic definitions, which is kind of why I'm trying to approach it in that way, because I'm trying to make it clear what I'm describing, so somebody else could take it to whoever and describe it in a way that would make it make sense to them.
Yeah, yeah, and I think I think you're right. I suspect that there's, as you defined, like knowing the difference between interactivity and play.
Yeah.
Even as like you were telling us before the show, you're kind of just inventing your way of describing.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You're not purporting to define this for other people.
Yes.
But the fact that those two behaviors and things are separate,
mm-hmm.
and not just like parts of game.
Yeah.
I think that's probably enough for someone who has no background in this to get up the hill to that understanding.
Sure. Yeah.
If not fully capturing.
I think so. Yeah, it's a framework to describe it. Where, like it's a spectrum you can define other games in.
Yeah.
I was trying to come up with like low interactivity versus high interactivity games or objects in the same way with like low play versus high play kind of things.
A good exercise might be just for yourself, listener at home, mm-hmm. Is to think of experiences or games, but think just any experience that has high interactivity and low play or high play and low interactivity. And that might help you think more about like in which of those would you describe as a game or not?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And how useful is that to even have an opinion on that for those things? The one I was thinking of is like you're driving on the highway and every exit you see like what the gas stations and restaurants are nearby.
Oh, sure.
And for like a lot of fast food places, you'll see the same ones every time.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes it's kind of fun to see like how many Burger Kings in a row.
Yeah.
And like it's like six. All right, 6 points. And like that doesn't.
Oh, yeah.
That's high play, but low interactivity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I had something like that as a kid too with Mini Coopers and VW Bugs, and I assigned point values for different colors and like whether or not it had racing stripes and stuff. And at the end of the day, I'd have a certain amount of points based on what I saw on the road.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of Mini Coopers that have racing stripes on them.
Yeah.
Okay.
I love Mini
And ostensibly,
Coopers.
Anyone who is playing along with you would have the same score.
Well, yeah. No. Well, sometimes you wouldn't notice, but I would have still announced it.
Well, I think there's more interactivity there then, just slightly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Some competitive components.
For sure.
Yellow and green VW Bugs are 1 point. Blue is 3, by the way.
according to the official regulation.
Yes. Convertible, you get extra points.
Ooh.
I think also, I mean, one of the things that I live off of analogies. I just run off of analogies. But a lot of the things that I think ends up making something like this click is if they can relate it to something.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's just true in general. So I think one of the things that I'm kind of curious about is if people, when they talk about Blippo Plus, what about it scratches that same part of their brain as another game?
Yeah.
Right?
That's great.
Because like, I think that's where it's like fun comes into it, but it's also like, you can have games that scratch very similar itches and are not at all like in the slightest.
Yes.
And that is very much up to taste. But I think that is kind of a vague or qualitative manifestation of interactivity and play and how they work in between the ears, which is where you're kind of focusing on, you know, what actually is a game is what's happening in your mind while you are engaging with the thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. What makes me think about what I'm thinking of when you bring that up is the game Dredge. Because like people describe that as a cozy game, even though it's like an existential horror game.
Yeah.
And also, and I find that really fascinating because like, you know, the Dredge is similar to like Animal Crossing in that way. And I think it's because of the way that you experience it until like, you know, until I guess it gets scary. I don't know. I haven't played the game. It's scary. like that is really fascinating to me because like it encompasses a lot of those similar ideas in a way that I think people can relate to and understand if you were to describe Dredge as a cozy game in that way. Yeah, okay. Well, thank you all for indulging me in this.
Oh, yeah.
In both of these things. Because I was a little concerned that, like, I was defining a thing and it would be controversial or wrong. And it seems like it's fine, so.
Yeah, not in this room.
Yeah.
I don't know. I get worried about lidologists.
Well, I gotta fight some fights for Mark anyway, so you know, if you have an issue with me, let me know so I can punch you in the face. Not actually, I'm sorry, listener.
Disclaimer. allegedly.
So you just heard from Steven really lay down the gauntlet. Now, if you do believe he's wrong, and Lord knows we all do from time to time, you got to think to yourself, there should be some easy avenue to express this feeling. Steven, it does such a venue exist?
It does. You can go to nicegames.club/feedback and let me know. Mm-hmm. So I know where to go. I know what's up.
Go to that forum, nicegames.club/feedback, mm-hmm. and tell Steven where to stick it. Because there actually is a question on that form.
Yeah.
To tell Steven he's wrong. But surely there's other things they can tell us.
That's true. You could tell us if something you like about the program. You could tell us which kinds of episodes you prefer. You could tell us neat parts of your demographic. Like if you just consider yourself a hobbyist, or you consider yourself in the industry, things like that. We'd like to hear about all those kinds of things. But also let me know if I'm wrong, so I know where to go. Nicegames.club/feedback.
Okay, my half of the show.
Oh, yeah, y'all cheated.
Yep. Lydia did my homework for me, which was very kind of you, Lydia. Thank you. So I'm going to let you start this topic because you brought it to me.
So previous episode, if you remember, I was talking about the escape room project that I did and I brought to Chicago, and just the kind of processing the experience of it wasn't as good as the one before. And kind of dealing with that.
Yeah.
And one of the things that, you know, in the moment after I was day two of working at the conference, but day one of having, you know, run it for people, I, you know, went back to the hotel room and I called Ian. I was talking about it because I really, truly didn't know what to feel. And Ian said something that was just so like crystallized and wonderful. I immediately just had to like write it on a sticky note so I wouldn't forget it. And it was, video games are the only art form with a fail state. Mm-hmm. In the sense of like, because it, and just trying to talk through it and why, you know, it felt kind of ambiguously like I couldn't really tell if it was I couldn't really know how to think of it as success because people were not able to finish it. They weren't able to win.
Yeah.
But also not everybody, like a lot of people seem to have enjoyed it, at least in part. And so there is that kind of it's also like an onus of, well, you have made something, and this you know, vehicle of creativity and art is a game, which you can lose.
Yes.
Which is not true for other art forms. And, you know, even if you are quote-unquote did a good job or are successful, it also sucks to see people lose because people like to win.
Yeah.
And I brought it... So this was kind of a piggyback topic on the one that I brought previously, but... I personally didn't really feel equipped to talk about it. And I brought it to Mark. I was like, hey, would you be willing? I had brought it up with Steven and Mark earlier when I was still in Chicago as, hey, is this an idea? It seemed like it was going to be two different topics. And I didn't necessarily feel equipped to do this part by myself. One, because it was so close to me.
Sure.
Two, because I have like my own weird feelings as far as like games and art. Like I agree that games are art. Mm-hmm. I don't personally think of myself as an artist or think of the things I make as art. Okay. And I don't know why necessarily. I think that's just like something to unpack at some point.
Yeah.
Maybe a separate topic.
Maybe.
Or maybe something you talk to your therapist about.
Probably.
Well, I can maybe offer a early theory which might not cover the whole thought that you have.
Fair.
Which is that the industry that you're in is very much games as a tool.
Yes, that's
and has
fair.
Art in it, which make it a better tool, and so that's the lens through which you see your work. But that said, you contain multitudes. You've also designed other things that are, you know, more strictly playful and might for most things just be like, oh, of course it's art. It's all art. All games are art.
Even that stuff I don't feel is art, and the stuff like I do fiber arts, ostensibly. I don't think of myself as a fiber artist. I think of myself as a crafter. I think of myself as a maker. I think of myself as a designer.
Okay. It might come from your other works then, because that sort of crafter kind of vibe has a different culture.
Yes, but that's also has its own loaded things because the craft arts or like cottage arts are typically undervalued and therefore not called art, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and like even as a dancer, I never thought of myself as an artist,
mm-hmm. yeah,
even though I considered myself a dancer and I was doing very artistic pieces. I was being a part of an artistic process. That is just, I don't know why the term applied to me doesn't feel right.
Got it. Okay.
So that was part of it. I didn't want
to. We are going to have to put a pin in that for later. Yeah. Okay. That is a huge thing.
Oh my God.
We're going to need to talk to you about later.
Okay. Cool. I'm. Yeah. Okay. Maybe that's what I bring to roundtable next time.
Okay.
Is tell Lydia why she's wrong.
NiceGames.club/feedback.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell Steven he's wrong and call Lydia an artist.
Yeah. This
is, like, I don't know why it is not something I feel comfortable doing, but it is a thing.
Yeah.
And so I knew that I didn't feel like I could engage with the topic in a way that, like, on the same level of it,
yeah.
even if I agreed with the premises of it.
Yeah.
This explains both why this very efficient aphorism that was delivered to you hit so hard.
Yeah.
And why you brought it to me, because like I'm always like flailing my arms about how everything is art and everyone's an artist.
Mm-hmm. Which I agree.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. But so I felt like because you engage with that idea so much and so vocally, you would have more of like the words to bring about the topic in a way that then could be played with in the middle of the room.
Yeah.
Whereas I felt like because I didn't quite have the words.
Sure.
And I gave it this, so I gave this topic to you essentially as like, can you kind of set the conversation up so that way then we can engage it, because I can't set up the pieces to have it become a conversation sure. that we could then talk about. What does this mean?
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's how I ended up giving Mark my idea.
It's still cheating.
I did the first half of my topic.
I don't have a problem with it.
I'm sure you don't.
And he just gave me a topic for later, so I guess
fair trade.
The pays, it is the law of equivalent
exchange.
Yeah,
what's Steven getting out of the deal? That's what I want to know.
You can tell me I'm wrong.
Okay.
Hey, you and I are good to get to tell her how much of an artist she is later.
That's
going to be
artist,
work
Lydia.
For us.
Yeah.
All right.
Anyway.
We'll divvy up responsibilities at a future date.
Sounds good.
This is definitely something I can engage with and kind of frame.
Yeah.
And the question is like, is my way of framing it, is that going to satisfy your curiosity at this? Now, you can let us know at the end.
Mm.
I think it may or may not.
I mean, that's fair.
I don't have like a full confidence. I would like to think so, but also if it doesn't, then I think we can do a part two and get at it from another direction.
Sure.
Yeah.
But so, listener, unbuckle from before, and then buckle now again for this.
Uh-huh.
Because I think the first thing I want to talk about is, you know, what does fail state even mean?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I think a lot of people, when they play games, they can't get past level two, and they never do, and they're done with it, and they failed the challenges of the game.
Yes.
Does that also mean that they didn't fully engage with the artistry of the piece?
Yeah. Mm. I mean, there's, for me, what was the first things that I kind of came up, again, analogies, is like, you can like a piece of art without understanding all of the art history and the
yeah.
intentionality of the artist, but you can still derive meaning and emotion and satisfaction from it. You can also reach a game to its conclusion and win the game and kind of hate yourself
not get
for it.
It. Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
not
yeah.
not get it, not like it, not find satisfaction from it. And are those dissimilar? Because the thing is that like you not understanding the like Renaissance historical context and symbolism of a particular painting doesn't necessarily mean that you can't look at the painting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's basically exactly how I approach this as a topic, is that I would not necessarily say it's the only art with a fail state, but it is very, it's probably the only art with a very like broadcasted a fail state.
Sure.
Mm. Because, you know, you can read Fight Club and then think that Fight Clubs are cool.
Yeah. And like, yeah.
Yeah.
Or probably see the movie and think Fight Club.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that is, I would say you failed that. The literacy of that.
That's how I was thinking of it too, is that like I think that books and movies and other forms of media do have fail states in that you're not understanding the message.
Right.
Like,
right. Mm. But now of course we're talking about failure in two different ways.
Yes.
Because you know, the fail state of that is really about literacy, understanding.
Yeah.
It's not like I don't know, I can't read this word.
Yeah.
It's just how it is in games.
Yeah.
In games it's like I didn't beat this boss, or like in a Mario game, like I fell down the hole 20 times and it gave me the power up the assist mode power up. Mm-hmm. Like, is that failure? And that is...
That is one thing that I did want to say. Like, I don't want to get into the discussion in terms of, like, assist modes or accessibility or accommodations to then complete the game and whether or not that is part of, like, means that you didn't get the artist message. Like, there's a lot of discourse about that.
Yeah,
that's a different conversation.
That is a facet of the conversation I did not want to engage with. Yep. As a thing.
Yep. Yeah, I think the point I want to make with it is that what is a fail state is itself, it feels like we know what that is when we're talking about games.
Yeah.
But like mechanically, every game defines it differently.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Through many different ways.
Yes.
Right? And I think it is, and that is what, that lends more credence to the quote, which is like, it's the only media that has that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, whether that makes it art, it's maybe the only media with it, but I think that's like separate from its definition as a piece of art.
Sure. Okay.
And it could be, I mean, you know, as a developer, it's something to think about. Like, if you are making a game that's very difficult and engaging with that difficulty is part of the understanding of it, mm-hmm. and somebody doesn't engage with that difficulty or gets bored of it.
Sure.
Or whatever. It's like, this game is 300 levels long. I have enough patience for 50 levels. And then, like, I think I understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you think of that person as a player of your game? Do you expect that person to have gotten the full experience? Or would you say that they haven't gotten the full experience?
Mm.
And that's separate from the difficulty conversation. That's really just about, like, you know, if you got to the end of the movie or something. Like,
yeah.
I think it would be not uncharitable to say if you only watched half a movie, you probably missed a lot.
Yes.
Yeah.
But in games, that's more common because of these mechanical fail states.
Yeah.
And for other reasons as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I think this is sort of going back to our earlier conversation about like how Blippo works. Like, Blippo has a very similar sort of engagement structure as linear media does.
Yeah.
In that you can stop watching at any time. You can stop engaging.
Yeah.
The game will never tell you to stop.
Yeah.
It'll never say game over. It'll never ask you to do a certain thing. There are criteria to watching through it, but they're not meant to be actual blocks for the player.
Yeah.
Because the game never tells you to go away,
mm-hmm.
you can only choose to go away.
Yeah.
Like, how is that actually different from how games do it? Because the game, you know, it could say, Mario, you ran out of lives, game over. It's not actually telling you you're done with it.
Right.
Yeah.
Because you can just press start and go again.
Yes.
Right.
And you're still playing.
Yeah.
You know, there's actually no way to fully lose a game in that sense.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you'd just be frustrated that you got to redo a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
You know? And maybe that's part of the experience. Certainly for lots of precision platformers, failure is a big part of the experience.
Yeah.
And I think that's maybe what Ian was kind of angling at, mm-hmm. for the emotional thing, because in the moment, part of what I felt I had failed as a designer because it seemed like I made a game that could not be won.
And so
I think, like, that's the thing, is there's a little bit of that emotion where it's like, that is so true. I mean, I fucking play roguelikes all the time. I know that that's not the end of the game. It doesn't mean that I literally just drop the Steam Deck and walk out of the house into the ocean.
That's what you do when you lose, right?
Yeah. You just return to the sea. And that is not the end, and that you can keep losing a game.
Yeah.
And still, or failing at completing something in a game, and still enjoy a game or have the game still be good, you know, whatever that means.
Yeah.
And that very much was not what I was feeling at the moment.
Yeah.
Sure.
And that's the thing. I think that might be kind of where it really was trying to aim for, is like, it's not, like, it in itself is, the premise is that you, with games, you could fail, you could lose, you could have to try again.
Right.
And that doesn't necessarily invalidate it. Like, that's part of the medium.
Yes.
And that is, like, hard baked into it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. It doesn't seem like that in other media.
Sure.
Necessarily.
I think that the way that I'm thinking of it is, mm-hmm. that a fail state, if you lose at something, if you get a game over, whatever, that is part of the experience.
Yeah.
And that is the art.
Mm-hmm.
Well, part of the art, I guess.
Yeah.
And so, like, I think that, like, if you think of it in that way, like, other media don't have fail states in that, like, you can't quote unquote lose at the thong song. I don't know. It's the only thing I can think of. in the moment. You can't lose it.
I mean, an example for the ages.
Yeah, but you kind of can't lose.
True. It's a great song, actually. But you can't actually Sender, lose like, that.
Nice games that call that feedback.
Is there a song you can't lose?
Well, to take advantage of the giggling, just sneak okay. my thought in here.
Sure, sure.
I think there is definitely, as a when you're creating linear media,
yes.
a novel or a film or a television show,
yeah.
there is, you can make choices that can alienate your audience
True.
In a deliberate way.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And basically, you're challenging them to stick with it, to understand it, to engage with it. And if they don't, then the quote-unquote failure is if they turn it off.
Oh, yeah. That's like right? when you brought the topic about friction. That yeah. would be like yeah. linear media yeah. built-in friction.
And now, I mean, we live in an environment where we think of games especially.
Mm-hmm.
But people know this about like Netflix shows as well. Like they're meant to be so approachable that yeah. they've told show directors to like make sure you have characters talk about what they're doing because people are going to be making dinner while they're watching your show.
Yeah.
And, you know, filmmakers have been kind of upset at that. But mm-hmm. there's a real reason they make those requests.
Right.
Because, like, now, as an artist, you might really bristle at that. And I really would bristle at that.
Sure.
But you understand the motivation of that. It's because...
It has a different intention.
Because the aim of it... And so yep. That makes it much more of how games are made.
Yes.
Where you really are thinking of, like, what do you want players to come on? How can I engineer this experience so that they reach this particular thing and make it... and whether it's quote unquote challenging or not, make it a challenge that they want to engage in.
Yes.
And that is why very frequently there will be films that are described as challenging.
Yeah.
Right. Mm. For basically the exact same reason.
Yeah.
Now I think Lydia, in your example, partly because you're in this context, you're making something as a tool
mm-hmm.
that mm-hmm.
that also can't be could be replayed, but not either like. Not potent, like only if you could book another time slot.
Yeah, the environment
the
was not
or
suited to.
You would get the yeah. digital version, which is the same puzzles but a different medium.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. yeah. So you had some difficulty there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think from sort of my sort of abstracted view of it, I would say that it that does no bearing on its success as a piece of art, but it might have bearing on its success as a tool.
Yeah,
you know, it essentially, and now I'm just being as like abstract as possible. It just said something different than what you probably wanted it to say. But it still said something.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, I think that you're touching on something that is actually quite true,
mm-hmm.
where it's like the work that I do has two kind of modes of success. And I try to intertwine them as tightly as I can because that makes a better game. Like
yeah.
the learning content and the gameplay mechanics have to beget each other.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's not going to make as good of a game.
Mm-hmm.
But you are right, where it's like, I think it's kind of, maybe it's, I don't know, it could be analogous to like dealing with a challenging piece of media and maybe not being able to finish it,
mm-hmm.
but being able to watch enough that you understood the message.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I couldn't win the game, but I learned something. That would still, like, that is still a success and at least one of the channels, right?
Yeah.
If you learn something from the game, even if you lost the game, you still learn something.
Right.
That's one of the measures we
have.
And
that's what I was trying to describe, is that, like, that is still part of the experience. You are still getting something out of it and learning something from it. And experiencing the human condition, blah blah blah, from this thing. Even if you went through World 1-1 in Mario and you weren't able to get to the end, that's still an experience.
Like if you try to, you're not someone who plays games.
Yeah.
Like you know that it's a really good example for level design, and you couldn't finish the level, but you understood now what they were talking about.
Yeah.
yeah.
Okay.
Right, and that's a very player centric view of that experience. Right.
Sure.
The thing about the developer side of that
is
like. I don't want people to get really comfortable being like, well, how whatever happens, happens, and it was something.
Yeah.
That is just literally true.
Yes.
Right? And that is partly why everything is art, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's like partly you made it and partly fate made it.
Uh-huh.
And so, like, that does not absolve you of the responsibility.
Right.
But I will say, if you're making something that is challenging, is a piece of work that is challenging in the way we've described,
mm-hmm. yes.
you essentially have to decide for yourself. Like someone watches half of it, they don't get the full message. Yes, they might get some of it, but you also have to accept that it's not going to reach as many people.
Right.
And that becomes almost a matter of like market fit.
Or they're going to reach it through unorthodox means, like me and horror games.
Perhaps,
I love horror games. They are, I think, like when I think of video games as art, I think of horror games first, honestly. They are some of the most beautifully intentionally crafted things that I know of, and I can't play them. And so like, oh my gosh, if you make horror games, I want to learn from you and talk about it. I can't play your stuff. I'm so sorry. Not myself.
Yeah. I think that the point I'm driving at is that certainly, Lydia, in your example, the tolerance you had for the amount of people who it wouldn't, that it wouldn't fully reach, you had a very low tolerance for that because your aims were for most, if not all, people to complete that experience.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, that may be, if you're making a video game where you have that exact same tolerance level, then you should feel the same way that you would have felt if you don't reach that level.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what tends to happen when you make something that's challenging in the sense we've described it is that you're, from jump, prepared for a high tolerance of people bouncing off of it or essentially failing to get what you know, putting time in but not getting the value out.
Yes.
And they might get something else out of it.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe they get half of what you intended.
Yeah.
But if your goal is for them, and now that applies to film or television, but it is also very true of games.
Yeah.
And that level of challenge is definitely not restricted to game overs.
Yeah, I think.
But it is, to go all the way back to the beginning, it is most obviously expressed through game overs.
Yeah,
I think there's something I think that you're touching on that there's a premeditated intentionality to that, which is very different than like a very defensive reactionary stance of like, well, you just didn't get it.
Yeah. Absolutely right.
Yeah. And that I'm much more accepting of and understanding of like, okay, there's a high threshold here and I might not hit it, but I would want to understand highest to my capability. And that also then tells me like, okay, well, maybe I won't get it fully, but I can get as close as I can.
Yeah.
As a starting premise, I think that makes it more engaging and more acceptable from a player perspective, or at least I hoped for it. Maybe not for everybody, but I think like as by default, like, oh, okay, if I don't get it, quote unquote, or if I don't finish it, or I don't meet that challenge threshold, I understand why, and that was the point.
Yes.
As opposed to if it's being used as a dismissive, reactionary impulse to people not meeting that.
Yeah. So that you've been bringing up horror stuff. I think of horror as also sort of an accessibility, approachability issue, because I am, you know, I'm also easily frightened. I can't play horror games too, just like Lydia.
Right. The scientific term is scaredy cat.
Yes. Steve, the scaredy cat. And I think that like, I think oftentimes people will put something scary or like jump scares or something like that in a game and not really think about the consequences of that thing.
Yeah.
It will turn me off from a game completely. If something to this day, I have not completed Sonic Adventure 2 because of the heckin' ghosts in that game. Oh, I just can't do it.
Yeah.
And so like I think like those kinds of things are signposts to me that this is the media that I will not be able to complete.
Right.
And so like I don't even necessarily think it's a failing of the game. I think that like it just means it's not for me.
Right. It's not your fault, it's not the game's fault. I think tellingly, Liddy, when you were describing like what this isn't, which is that like reactionary, like blame the player kind of thing.
Right.
I think that is, I think it does go both ways. It's like there are, and I think as software developers, as well as game designers, we tend to think in the sort of UX realm of like, if you do it right, everyone will enjoy it. And it's just not how it works.
It's not
no.
And that, I think that because I think everything is art and everything should have some intentionality behind it, you have to be prepared. If not planning it in advance, who is not going to understand it?
Mm-hmm.
You are making a choice about what your thing is.
Yeah.
And so you have to be ready for not everyone to understand it.
Yeah.
And then you have to decide, like, well, if no one's getting it, then what's the point of saying it?
Yes.
So maybe I'll change it so more people will get it.
Yeah.
And there's many ways to do that in many types of media.
Mm-hmm.
But then you can also say, okay, well, now that I've changed it so more people get it, is the thing they're getting now watered down?
Right.
And so there's really no one answer to that question.
Well, yeah, I think then, I mean, we are tipping into accessibility, which I said we weren't going to go too far into, but that's okay. Cause I think like, maybe the dipping our toes into it is the going back into like, if this was intentional or not.
Yeah.
And that also then goes back into your design pillars of, is this particular thing enough of a design pillar that it cannot be compromised upon?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My first thought is one of the very easy accommodations that you can make is having an agora or a arachnophobia mode.
Sure.
Which subs out spiders or spider-like things for other 3D models or 2D models.
Yeah.
Because if you have spiders for them to just be a creepy mob, boss, whatever, then you can just hot swap them out and then someone can complete the game. Mm-hmm. If you're making a game that's like all about Lolth the Spider Queen from Faerun, like the Underdark in Faerun, that might not work.
Yeah.
And I think like then that is on you to think, okay, am I okay with people not engaging with everything else that is important to me about this game because it is about Lolth the Spider Queen? And I don't want to, and having an arachnophobia mode would dampen the message that, or lean it too far, whatever.
Yeah.
Then that is something that you have to kind of, you're saying is like, you have to examine your own intentions. You have to
own those choices.
Yeah.
Like, how important were those ghosts to Sonic Adventure 2? And how much should they have really put in any extra effort to make sure that you played this game?
Right.
And those are all, I mean, it's really, there's no rubric to make to answer this question. But you have to own the choices.
I don't know this game, so it could be that ghosts were important for that part of the game, or it could just be like, what's an enemy that we haven't thrown at them in a while? We got some ghost models from last Tuesday, we could just throw them in. The intern did them. Yeah, that'll work, we'll just have ghosts.
Having never worked at AAA, I'm assuming that's how it works.
I don't know.
But I, to bring it back to fail states, this the intentionality of why you have a fail state in your game is to have purpose too, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think the reason why oftentimes fail states are in there is because like the developer is presenting a challenge to the player, and the developer expects the player to rise up to that challenge.
Right.
And that challenge does not necessarily have to be a very difficult challenge.
Yeah.
But it has to have a fail state for it to feel like a challenge.
Right. Yeah. And there's even like the fake outs, like, oh, I'm not supposed to win this boss battle yet.
Yeah.
those kinds of things.
Yeah. Like, that plays into it though, because it has to be done intentionally so you understand what's happening.
Yes.
Because then the implication, ideally, the message is someday you will be returned to this fight and you will be prepared.
Right.
But if it's not done well, then it's just like, what?
Yeah.
Well, that's playing with the language of effort and failure.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In a way that is very obvious when you have those like fake out things. And then it's like, this is not actually a challenge for a player to engage, but we're using the language of that to express that.
Yes.
When it actually literally is a challenge that you can succeed or fail at, it is still using the language of effort and failure.
Yes.
And it isn't actually that much different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? But I mean, there's logistically, you know, there's a limit to everything is everything in terms of like what you're doing day to day when you're actually making these things.
Yeah.
So like, don't let this spin you into an endless cycle of like, what does it all mean? but I think a lot of times people think about making, you know, sort of tweaks or exceptions or little things and not realizing that how much of the same sort of mind space that you're engaging the player with because the tools are actually a little different.
Yeah.
And not realizing when they're doing two totally separate mechanical things, how much they're basically the exact same.
Yeah.
Because they're thinking of it only in a mechanical sense.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. It all kind of blends together in a weird way. Now I'm doing the thing Mark told me not to do.
It's okay. I mean, you're a game dev. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
We'll end this by sort of asking if this was hopefully, well, maybe not. I mean, if it didn't, I think that's okay too, because you know everything is something. But if it satisfied your interest in this topic,
mm-hmm. I think it worked pretty well. I mean, especially being able to talk about through like what is it like with other pieces of art, especially because like I don't really watch films. I know you two really like film, and film is also one of those things where like you can kind of just experience it and then enjoy it. Like I like look at the painting and you like it versus really get it and go deep into it. It's one of those pieces of art.
Mm-hmm.
So I think like I knew it was going to be a good conversation. I think we ended up with a good conversation. Yeah. I guess I didn't necessarily expect it to go in all the way back into the like design pillars early on of like intentionality for what do you want for your player, not in like a, I don't know. It's very interesting because it's such a premeditated thing.
Yeah.
But also we work in a very openly like prototype and see what happens kind of way. And we're good, fine with that. And as game devs, we play test and we tweak and we experiment. And so it's a weird mixture of like times and like kind of.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a very interesting thing to have like touched on that.
Well, I think every topic we have is like water in a bathtub. And if we don't plug all the drains all the way down to the everything is everything, it's all eventually going to seep down into it.
Uh-huh.
And so I did definitely appreciate that you wanted us to keep away from like sort of difficulty levels and accessibility, because it is so intertwined with that, but it is a separate thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think that is really, hopefully we were able to explore that without like wading too deep into that water.
Mm-hmm. I think so. Because, like, again, I also, there is, you think about that, the negative a lot, but you also do think, I do think a lot of the positive, like, I never finished this game, but I really liked it.
Yeah.
And, like, you may never pick it up again. Mm-hmm. Maybe not even just for, like, you know, life happened or you lost your copy or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's just, oh, I never finished, but I loved when I played it.
Yeah.
You know, there's that question, too, of, like, did I fail? Did you fail?
Yeah.
From whose perspective failed? And then what do you do about it? Do you do anything about it? It itself is not a fail state in a really weird way.
Yeah, yeah. I think as developers, we really imagine our players as speedrunners.
Yeah.
Like we think that they will work them their way up to that. We're not fool ourselves into thinking everyone's going to be like amazing at our games.
Yeah.
But we kind of have this like fantasy of the player as someone who's working towards this thing. It's not easy, but like to think about like someone who will bounce off of it,
mm-hmm.
who will lose level two and not come back.
Yeah.
What are we offering them? Because you can go both ways. You can say that person can bounce off and then I don't have to think about them anymore. That's fair.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can say that person can bounce off and I want to make sure I leave them with something.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
think about the whole experience in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Discuss this episode, or others, or whatever, with your fellow listeners on Discord. Stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.